Hi, this is Cynthia Davis, and in this edition of Homefront, I talk with my friend Daryl Castle. We get into what is happening with the U.S. Supreme Court and what we need to know about the upcoming decisions that will determine the definition of marriage in our country. We have some answers for you, like change your clothes and get back to work. As an added bonus, we delve into some thoughts on the presidential candidates, the upcoming debates, and campaign funding for 2016.
I'm an American!
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time. As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront. Welcome to Homefront. Today we have Daryl Castle, again, the premier attorney from Memphis, Tennessee. He also is a popular guest and commentator on the legal issues and government behavior. So today we want to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court and some of the upcoming decisions. When I was in the Missouri House of Representatives, I was on the committee that heard the bill that put the question to the voters. Shall marriage be between one man and one woman? And it passed once it got on the ballot by about 71% of the vote and went into our Missouri Constitution. At that time, we were told that anytime a state puts the question on the ballot, it always passes handily. And obviously, 71% is nothing to sneeze at. However, the tides are changing. The popularity of homosexuality has increased so much that we're now seeing when states put it on the ballot, they're losing. What I'd like to know from your perspective is when you let the people decide, that makes it more palatable. Same with the abortion debate. People can decide state by state whether they want it or not. What is your opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court and what they may be deciding in June this year?
Well, first of all, we had the same thing in Tennessee that you talked about in Missouri. We had it on our ballot and it passed by 81%. But the Supreme Court has taken it on itself for many years to decide what law is and whether law complies with the Constitution. And they're not really concerned about what the people want. That's irrelevant to them. What they're concerned about is what they want. I mean, I'm not saying there's an evil motive in that. I'm just saying that they don't trust the people to decide. They're jurists, and they can look at the Constitution as it changes and evolves over time, and they can steer society the way they want it to be. What do I think of the court? Well, I mean, I'm a lawyer, so I respect the judicial process and the system of justice. I still think it's the best one in the world, but times are changing, and things that we once held dear are changing. I remember reading a speech that John Kennedy gave. In fact, I did a podcast about it. Back in 1963, 6 months before his death, we had just had the prayer in schools vote by the Supreme Court, and Kennedy was concerned about that, about how he would explain that to the people, because he knew the people were not supportive of it, and the people would not like it, and he had to say something to uphold the system, he felt. So he went before the American public, and he said, you know, we've had this ruling that says our children can't pray in school anymore, so I guess we will have to make the time to pray more with them at home than ever. You know, that a graceful way to explain it. But if this decision comes down bad, like we expect, we'll have to deal with it.
In looking at the presidential candidates, it's interesting watching some who have claimed that they used to be in favor of marriage between a man and a woman, and now there's a lot of shifting going on. And the reason the candidates are shifting their views is because they're following the view of the public. The public is following the view of the media. So we've got the media out in front directing the band. You've got the voters listening to what they are being inundated with all the time on the news, TV, radio, the comedy shows you see in the evenings, which aren't really that funny, people making fun of marriage, and people flaunting, highlighting, and marqueeing the perversion. The media makes it popular. Then the voters go to vote. They get all confused. They think, well, we better be in favor of it because that's hip. Just to show how views have changed, and this is something that I love about the Constitution Party, because we don't have to change as soon as something becomes more popular. We can look at the dynamics of what's happening in our country and observe, but what we're seeing is where the country is going off the train tracks, not where we need to be. Just because the train goes off the tracks doesn't mean everybody needs to follow. Somebody needs to give some clarity to the discussion. So let me read you an amazing quote by Hillary Clinton, of all things. She has gone through this huge transition herself on what she thinks about marriage. In 1996, she admitted that she would likely have been in favor of the Defense of Marriage Act at that time. In January of 2000, she gave a speech. Here's Hillary's quote. "Marriage has got historic, religious, and moral content that goes back to the beginning of time. And I think a marriage is a marriage, has always been, between a man and a woman." So now you look at her today, she already said marriage is the historical context from the beginning of time. And here we have her today. She won a Grindr's Gay Icon of the Year award. So we're looking at a huge change. Now, there's another presidential candidate. Ben Carson said whatever the Supreme Court says, that's what he'll respect. This week, Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina said she would not fight a ruling in favor of marriage equality. Watch the vocabulary words. She now joins Lindsey Graham, who's another 2016 potential candidate, on a similar statement. So you've got Republicans who are coming out saying, yeah, if that's what the Supreme Court says, fine. Where is it time to fight, and when is it time to stand our ground?
That's an interesting question. People think that that's what the people want. They weren't listening to the 81% of the people in Tennessee who voted to keep marriage as it is, or the 71% in Missouri. But you're right, that's what the media tells us, and the people who set out to deliberately destroy this country and forcibly have control of every one of our venues of power, from the media on down. So they tell us how we should think and how things should be, and who's to resist the Supreme Court. You know, since we've lost our religious faith, I mean, God doesn't change. He doesn't evolve over time. He doesn't say, well, you know, the times are changing, so that's what the Supreme Court says. Those of us who see it that way are not going to change. But the fact is, Fight? I mean, what do you mean by that? Fight in what way? If the court says what we expect it to say, and that becomes accepted as law in America, in your heart, you can see it any way you want to. We are in exile. We're in a far country. God sent the Israelites into exile because of their wickedness, and for 400 years they stayed in that land. But what did he tell them to do there? Participate in the country, be a part of society, but understand that this is not your home. That's where we are now. I mean, as Christians, I mean, we're a people in exile in our own country. At least that's the way I see it.
Well, let me ask you, how do we correct the direction? Because this is going to make it very difficult for people to have some stability. You think about the children. What is the next generation going to learn, observe, and behave like when they see the example and the direction we're going? The trend is establishing itself. The fewer marriages there are, the more confused the next generation. They're not going to see the example. It reminds me of a story that a friend of mine told me. He was living in the urban core of St. Louis with his wife and two children. One of his sons had a friend come over for dinner. While they were sitting there eating dinner, the boy said to the father, "So where do you live?" And the father was shocked at the question. He said, "Right here, this is my house, this is my table, this is my food, this is my wife, and these are my children." And this child had not seen an intact family where people all sit down and have dinner together. To him, his only example he'd seen is the man shows up once in a while to pollinate the women and then goes on to another home for another meal another night. And he had, this was a foreign concept. We're moving that direction where if children don't see what should be, if they don't observe the model, how are they going to navigate to create and recreate the model in their own future?
Yeah, I think, Cynthia, to answer your question, as far as my view of it, when you make a mistake in immigration and you open up your borders a little bit more than perhaps you should, you can correct that quite easily. When you involve yourself in some foreign conflict that perhaps you shouldn't, sometimes it's difficult to extricate yourself, but you can extricate yourself. I mean, most of these decisions can be corrected. But this is a permanent decision. It's not it's not correctable. And once it happens, the way I see it, it's one more step toward total destruction of society and culture that we spent 800 years building, that's being torn down really, very rapidly right in front of our eyes. And as far as you're pointing out the illegitimacy and so forth, yes, that is the last figure I saw among black families, 73% now, with obvious results. It's a complete destruction of society. You can trace it back almost to the day when the Great Society started and all the welfare programs were started to make fatherless single-parent homes financially feasible. What you subsidize, you get more of. So with each passing day, it gets worse as we have fatherless males running around at that particular age group, which is full of energy and so forth, doing what they do. It's a destruction of our known society, you know, now approaching 50% of the people totally dependent, and it's only going to get worse. So where it goes, I mean, it doesn't look good, I'll be honest about it.
What is the role of the Supreme Court then? Can you just help us understand if they're supposed to be interpreting our laws as they apply to the Constitution? Why should they come up with new decisions that are moving the country further to the left? Theoretically, they are here to define the constitutionality of our laws. yet we're in a scary point because now two of the women on the Supreme Court have actually performed marriages between people who are of the same sex. So they should recuse themselves. If we're not going to have a rogue court, the rules of the court should be, if you've already publicly acknowledged that you think that's okay enough to where you're officiating at that kind of ceremony, how can you, in all clear conscience, make a decision for or against that type of marriage?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. You want me to comment on the legality of it and what the court is, but it does no good. I mean, there is nothing that's ever happened with the Supreme Court. The Constitution doesn't give the Supreme Court any superior role in our society. In fact, of the three-legged stool of government, the Supreme Court is actually last. They have no role in making law. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the Supreme Court is anything other than a case-by-case decider. Who gave them the authority to decide what the Constitution is? It's simply the last resort court. Nevertheless, they have taken on this role. That position in our society has existed certainly since Oliver Wendell Holmes decided that the Supreme Court could take that authority. And no one is going to take it from them. But so it's pointless to make the argument that I just made. It is what it is. And whether the Supreme Court has the legal right to do it or not, it is taken upon itself, and the people have accepted, Congress has accepted, the right of the Supreme Court to decide what law is and whether law complies with the Constitution or not. In my opinion, they're going to look for a safe way out on this. Some of the more aggressive ones, as you point out, the two women, might see it differently. But the people who see themselves as kind of independent deal makers, like John Robertson, they're going to look for a safe way out, like sexual discrimination. They're going to say, okay, think about it like this. Mary can marry Joe. Mary loves Joe, and Mary can marry Joe. Tom loves Joe, but Tom can't marry Joe. That's clear sexual discrimination. So that's their ruling. The most likely thing, and the easiest for them to explain. They don't have to appear to be fundamentally restructuring our society. They're just saying this violates our laws against sexual discrimination. But in reality, nothing could be further from the truth.
Can John Roberts force two people who've publicly acted in favor of this type of union, can John Roberts force them to be recused? I mean, every time a judge runs for office, at least in Missouri, you can't get an answer out of them on anything. Because if you ask, what is your position on this issue, they always say, I can't disclose that because that would be the same as trying a case I've never heard before. And I don't want to go on the record as being for or against an issue. So can you, as a lawyer, explain to us how any judge can legitimately rule on an issue where he is already or she has already behaved in a manner that shows an overt support for one side?
Well, it's a clear violation of their oath, and they should be recused. The answer, can he force them? No, the court's never going to do anything to appear to the public to be divided. Even though in their private discussions, a person of conscience might say to them, you know, you really should recuse yourself on this, but they don't. The court's not going to get into a fight or an argument. No more than going to say in their dissent, you know, we have two justices here. This is an invalid decision because two justices have already decided they don't need to listen to any arguments, you know, and so forth. The court values the appearance of union more than anything else, I think.
There is nothing that a marriage between homosexuals can accomplish for them that cannot be accomplished through private contracts. So this whole facade that they want marriage is only a facade. Most of the people who are availing themselves of the marriage opportunity is more women than men. Men, what's in it for them? It's not about the legal accomplishment. It's about they want society's approval. They want people to recognize them so that they can have some honor that belongs to people who are honorably married. So the Harvard Law School professor, Michael Plerman, predicted that all 50 states will legislatively adopt same-sex marriage within 10 years if the political process is left to run its course. But the U.S. Supreme Court could short-circuit that political process and make it happen by judicial fiat. How do you think we should react if we have a rogue court? What is the remedy? What is our choice? How do we protect the bedrock of society?
That's a question that, I mean, how can I answer that question, Cynthia? I mean, how can you protect the bedrock of society? I mean, this is a sinister attack against God, to be perfectly blunt about it. It's an attack against Western civilization. It's an attack against everything that is holy, that we hold dear. I mean, our entire society is being torn down right around us on purpose. Every aspect of our society opposes us: education, business, finance, industry, you name it, media. As I said, we're in exile in a far country. And if I'm a Christian, so I look at the Bible. You look at what David did when he was praying about his son. He prayed, he fasted, he didn't eat for days. People were worried about him. About his son, praying for the life of his son. And when God said, no, this is my judgment, and he was told that his son was dead, he got up, he went in, he bathed, he changed his clothes, he came out, he ate, he went in the temple, and he worshiped, and he went back to work. That is what we are to do, in my opinion.
We're supposed to change our clothes and get back to work?
Yes.
Okay, that's a good word for us. Hey, by the way, while I have you here, I do want to ask you an interesting question. With all the GOP stuff going on in the news, obviously there isn't a lot of discussion about other parties, but there was an article that came out recently that says White House hopeful Ben Carson is calling on the Republican National Committee to allow all qualified candidates to take part in the upcoming debates, despite their standings in the polls. I like watching this all unfold, and I know some of our listeners are politically minded enough to care as well. Ben Carson sent a letter to the Republican National Committee Chairman Reese Priebus as the party finishes up its spring meetings in Phoenix. Media reports from the event suggest the party may either cap the number of candidates allowed in the debates or restrict the list to those who reach a certain threshold in the polls. And this is Ben Carson's quote: "Limiting participation of qualified candidates on this reasoning, I believe, does our party a tremendous disservice," Carson said in his email, which was released by his campaign. He specifically cited himself and Carly Fiorina as two candidates that could see themselves at odds with the debate gatekeepers. I love the idea that somebody wants to open up free speech. I don't care who it is. When you deny the American public the opportunity to hear from all the candidates, what you're doing is blocking their access to information. It doesn't even matter the political party. What matters is the process. Do you have an opinion on what we need to see to open up America's minds to other ideas?
Well, when Ben Carson said that, he said qualified candidates. So I guess it depends on what you think a qualified candidate is. I mean, the Republican Party's idea of what a qualified candidate is, I'm sure, a lot different than his. But certainly I'm in favor of more participation. I mean, obviously, as a Constitution Party candidate, that's one of our bedrock principles. We should be allowed a voice in the political process, but we're not. Of course, they don't talk about us when they talk about qualified candidates. They're talking about themselves, but that is something we should work for. It's difficult to conduct a debate with 16 candidates up there at the same time. Nevertheless, they should find some way to do it, or some way to allow everyone to present their views. You know, the people who like Jeb Bush and people who might be what they call top tier candidates are in the top two or three of the polls. So they certainly don't want these other people involved, because they might actually gain popularity. I mean, people might hear them and actually want them. That is their fear. No, they don't want anybody to hear them. So the idea is to give no media coverage, so that no one ever knows what these people think or what kind of a candidate or elected official they might possibly be. They only want you to be served up the media's chosen front runner. So what can we do about that? Well, the people can have what they want. I mean, they still fear us. We're still more than they are. We sit by and we accept what the media gives us. I mean, that is a Republican thing, and it's going to take Republicans to change it if that's what they want. If the majority of the Republican Party wanted that system changed, it would be changed.
Well, in the legislature, we used to say, you need to give him enough rope so he can hang himself. And I have to admit, I love the idea of letting people explain their philosophy, because if they're given the opportunity in a free forum where they don't have all prepared answers, we're going to get more candor out of them. We're going to get more objective truth. And if some of the candidates are frauds, they'll be exposed for the fraud that they are. The other point is that we can all learn a lot by watching debates, especially if they're an honest debate, not just somebody reading a prepared speech. Unfortunately, most of the time it's all polished. The GOP, when they're referring to the front runners, they're not referring to the best candidate. They're referring to the candidate who's raised the most money. It's all about the money. If they raise the most, then they get to be in the top slot. If they don't raise the most, then they're lower on the list. I will never forget how I felt when I was watching the debates a few years ago for the GOP, and Rick Santorum was trying to explain why he voted for Title X, which is money that goes to Planned Parenthood. The question was, how could you spend money, taxpayer money, supporting Planned Parenthood when you claim to be pro-life? So you're paying for abortions on the one hand, and then you're claiming that we shouldn't do abortions on the other hand. How do you explain it? And Rick Santorum had the gall to say he voted for Title X because he also voted for Title V, and that neutralized each other, and therefore he could go to bed at night with a clean conscience. Title V had a line item for abstinence education. Well, if I were there, I would have told him, excuse me, Santorum, that you can't fix the expenditure of one illegitimate taxpayer fund with another illegitimate taxpayer fund. It doesn't work out that way. Throwing more money doesn't neutralize it. Maybe it works with vinegar and baking soda. It does not work with public policy. So anyway, I tell you this just to excite my audience and to let you know, Daryl, that I'm excited about some people who can just be honest. I hope that we get to have some good debates. I don't care what parties are doing it. When we hear their philosophy, we learn every time. We learn what's in their hearts. We learn what's in our hearts. Sometimes there are people who know what they believe, but they don't know how to say it. Yet, when they hear it, They recognize it. And that's what I'm hoping that people will get from listening to Homefront. They'll hear a philosophy that makes sense. So is there anything else you'd like to tell America? Just wrap up the whole time. What are we supposed to do and march us forward?
Well, I'll have a couple of things to say, if you permit me. In response to what you just said, you said it's all about the money. The ones who raise the most money are considered top-tier candidates. So it seems that what you're really saying there is the most perverted and people closest to being actual prostitutes who are willing to sell themselves for money are the top-tier candidates. Those are the choices that we have. Something should be done about that. We should find some way to solve that problem. That's my view anyway. And right now, I don't know what that is. I know that there are some things that could do it that seem unacceptable to us, but we should consider as people something to solve that problem. Now, finally,
Daryl, let me interrupt you before you move on from that, because the one answer that most people are proposing would solve that problem is public funding of campaigns, saying government will give you X amount of dollars, you spend that much and no more. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the Constitution Party is officially opposed to that, and I suppose I am too, Cynthia. But I do look at it, and I do think the alternative is so horrible. You know, I don't want to go on record as being someone who favors public funding of elections, but I do think it is a concept that could at least be looked at to see what are the advantages and disadvantages. What would doing something like that do to us? Something that would prevent people from spending their time raising money to campaign with, selling themselves to foreign governments for campaign money, because that would be a crime under this concept of public funding. All you would have is a certain amount of money and nothing else. So I have mixed feelings about it, I suppose, is the answer. I see the alternative as being something really terrible that's going to get worse and worse, but I'm not totally certain that's the best answer.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted your stream of thought.
No, that's something that I've thought about from time to time. I've thought, you know, what if I, as a Constitution Party person, what if we had a Democrat, a Republican, a Green Party, a Libertarian candidate, and a Constitution Party candidate? And each one of us had $50 million and nothing else. That's it. That's all you get to campaign with, you know, do your best and we'll see who wins. We would have an entirely different electoral process and an entirely different country, I guarantee you. That's why nothing like that can ever happen.
I believe in a level playing field. Right now, what's going on with the cost of campaigns is you've eliminated every real person. If you back up to what history was like during the time of our founding fathers, they never imagined this kind of millions of dollars being spent on campaigns. Even in my own state, for a state Senate race, people are spending $500,000 to win an office that pays $35,000 a year. Can you explain that one to me? That's not $500,000 of their own money. That's all lobbyist money. And so we have perverted the process irretrievably. If nothing changes, all the seats in every office will be purchased by the highest bidder. Is that the kind of government we want? Because it's already happening. If people cannot see it, they need to open their eyes and observe what has happened. I don't see how we can correct it in any other way.
I'm right with you on that, Cynthia. I don't either. I mean, if there's another way, show it to me. And also, as you just pointed out, if something isn't done to correct it, as H.L. Mencken said, all you have is an advanced auction of stolen goods.
That's it. Well, Daryl, it has been a delight, and I know that your time is extremely valuable. I'm so grateful that you gave us a few minutes out of your busy day, and I just want to thank you. Will you be on our show again sometime to offer more illumination on how to fix the country?
Anytime, Cynthia. It's always a pleasure.
This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.